Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. Today, we will discuss a review article titled "A Multisystem Physiological Perspective of Human Frailty and Its Modulation by Physical Activity." Joining us are Associate Editor Christoph Hanchin and authors Professor Paul Greenhalgh and Professor Janet Lord. Professor Hanchin, over to you.
So welcome to our Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Christoph Hanchin, Associate Editor of Physiological Reviews and Professor at the Biozentrum of the University of Basel. Today, I have the great pleasure of hosting Professor Janet Lord and Professor Paul Greenhalgh, who together with junior and senior colleagues from their centers, as well as other institutions, have co-authored a recent outstanding manuscript on human frailty and its modulation by physical activity in Physiological Reviews. Janet Lord is a professor at the Institute of Inflammation and Aging at the University of Birmingham, and it is the director of the MRC versus Arthritis Center of Musculoskeletal Aging Research. Paul Greenhalgh is a professor at the School of Life Sciences, University of Nottingham, and is deputy director of the MRC versus Arthritis Center for Musculoskeletal Aging Research. Professor Lord and Professor Greenhalgh have a longstanding interest in studying and understanding muscle metabolism and function in the context of aging, sarcopenia, and frailty. By joining forces for this review, the extensive and formidable knowledge of Professor Lord, Professor Greenhalgh, and the other co-authors, attested to by numerous highly cited and enormously appreciated publications, synergized to result in a broad overview on this topic, including aspects of muscle deconditioning, physical activity, neuronal principles, inflammation, molecular mechanisms, and more. It therefore is my honor and pleasure to be able to discuss some of these points with Professor Lord and Professor Greenhalgh in today's podcast. Janet, Paul, thank you for taking the time to do this and for the wonderful contribution to Physiological Reviews. First, I would like to clarify what the term frailty actually means and how this is clinically defined. To many, this might seem like a vague description of a condition that is clear when you see a corresponding individual, but frailty obviously is much more than that. Thus, how does frailty manifest itself and how is it diagnosed?
That's a very good question, Christoph. And as you say, most clinicians will know a frail person when they see them. But what underlies that frailty is what's not clear and what the review discusses. So it's a decline, it's a multi-system decline in older adults largely that manifests itself in a reduced resilience to some sort of challenge. This could be an infectious challenge, it could be a fall. And the individual doesn't respond by recovering to where they were prior to the challenge. So that's the sort of simple clinical definition. But how it's actually assessed is interesting, Christoph. So it's largely assessed through either a frailty index, which is usually very simple. It measures things like their walking speed, strength. It could be hand grip strength, unintentional weight loss. Or there are other scales that are a little more detailed. So there's a 40 variable scale, which really catalogues the decline in inabilities. So it's a deficit model. But none of those really tell you much about what's driving the frailty and about its heterogeneity. They're simple sort of clinical definitions used for assessment in a clinical situation. I don't know whether Paul wants to add anything to that.
Yeah, just to say, you know, the concept of frailty has really originated as a clinical tool to assess a patient. And it's becoming increasingly clear that physiology or pathophysiology is really something that can inform more about this clinical measure. So that for physiologists is a really good thing. So at the moment, frailty generally is an operational tool used in hospitals right across the world, but it definitely has a physiological basis.
So I guess frailty affects, you know, many patients and many diseases, but aging is probably the context where we're all at risk of becoming frail. So are there specific risk factors that can increase the chance of becoming frail? And is frailty always a problem or only if a certain pathological threshold is met?
Very important point. So there are certainly risk factors for this, age being the largest one, but also things like deprivation scale, so socioeconomic deprivation. Female sex is another risk factor. There's some ethnicities that are more at risk as well. So there are certainly drivers there. Physical inactivity is another one that I'm sure we'll discuss more as well in this interview. They're all risk factors for developing frailty. And by its very definition, Christoph, it is important clinically because the patient has, or the older adult has reached a threshold at which the various systems in the body are not functioning and are having a clinical impact. So yeah, it's clinically important. But I think important to get across that it's not inevitable, although it is age-related. If you can stay physically active and avoid various other of the risk factors, then you can reach old age in a non-frail state and stay that way for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there you're already leading into my next question. So what can we do against frailty? And as you said, and also prominently discussed in your review, physical activity for sure is one measure. But you also mentioned nutrition and other factors. So how much can we achieve by such measures? Are there interventions such as drugs that show promise? What can we do?
I think what we can do, or most importantly, what we need to do is try and understand what the physiological drivers of frailty are. So at the moment, it's seen as a whole body holistic type of condition. You know, it's measured by things like grip strength, simple tests. So what we need really are to break this down and to start looking at the contribution of multiple organ dysfunction to the whole body characteristics. I think once we have clarity on that, then you can probably have your best chance of targeting interventions to have the best outcome. So, you know, if someone is clearly very sarcopenic, you want to either target the neuromuscular system or skeletal muscle itself. And in that situation, as long as someone is in positive energy balance, I can't see increasing nutritional intake will have an effect per se. You will need to contract the muscle. You will need to increase metabolic rate. You will need to increase muscle fiber recruitment. We need a more sophisticated approach to start with to come up with targeted interventions that are more likely to work. However, I would say that because exercise, you know, it's emerging in the published arena that exercise is hitting multiple organs. You know, there's a very good relationship, for example, between brain gray matter volume and physical activity levels, which is probably linked to, I'm guessing, it's linked to habitual physical activity levels. So exercise is likely to be a powerful intervention. There are lots of studies that have been performed with exercise. You have the large epidemiological type studies where you can look for associations, but under those conditions, it's very difficult to control the dose of exercise, so the intensity and the frequency. And then there are smaller studies where it's easier to control these things. So, you know, Bill Evans in the 90s did landmark studies where he actually did quite intense training in care homes in people in their 90s and was able to produce positive effects on muscle mass and strength. So exercise, I think, however we proceed, exercise will be definitely a good intervention. And we need to know more about the dose frequency, and we need longitudinal studies to understand the rate of change and at a multi-organ level, not just muscle.
I think that's true. And certainly in relation to physical activity, so my area of the immune system, we've shown in older adults who've stayed physically active into their older age that their immune system doesn't decline. And in fact, some of them have got the output from the thymus of a 20-year-old. So there's certainly impact on another key system there. And I think coming down the line, we mentioned it in the review, that in addition to exercise and nutritional approaches, there are also approaches to actually target aging processes themselves. So one that's been done, the first actual trial in humans, was in a condition called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And we know that the frailty there, a lot of it is down to reduced lung function due to the buildup of senescent cells in the lung. And what they've done in that trial is done short-term interventions with drugs called senolytics to get rid of the senescent cells. And those patients, it was only a short trial, but they had reduced frailty, so improved walk times, improved strength. So I think, you know, in addition to physical activity that both Paul and I would absolutely champion, it may be that there are other therapeutics also coming down the line that may help patients who are already very frail.
I think there's an interesting debate progressing. So for an elderly person, particularly a frail person, there's the idea that, you know, is their protein intake sufficient and to stimulate or maintain muscle protein turnover? So that's one end of the debate, if you like. The other end of the debate is that the studies showing caloric restriction extends life. And, you know, there are now studies going on in human volunteers. So to me, caloric restriction would actually result in lower muscle protein synthesis. And it begs the question, does caloric restriction extend life? Possibly yes, but then what happens to quality of life in relation to muscle mass, body composition? So it's an interesting debate around nutrition.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Paul. And certainly the problem we've got is that most of these studies are in mice at the moment, and we really haven't got enough data in humans. But certainly in the mice, they've moved on and done intermittent fasting rather than permanent caloric restriction. And interestingly there, that they certainly don't lose muscle mass, which is has always been as the concern that you've raised. But yeah, what would happen in humans, and I certainly would never calorically restrict a frail older adult.
Yeah, I mean, what I gather now from your response is that, I mean, on one hand, we have some, I think, generally applicable interventions like exercise, but maybe also some very individual, you know, or individualized interventions to kind of, you know, have to be done in a personalized manner. But I also understand is that better knowledge of the mechanistic aspects might help to guide us in the future. So what do we know about these mechanistic aspects at the moment, and how important do you think this will be to improve our understanding and treatment of frailty in the future?
Well, we know, for example, as we get older, a feature of our aging is sarcopenia. A feature of our aging is insulin resistance, you know, in response to glucose feeding. But what is driving this, we don't yet know. So if you look at an old person, for example, the ability of protein feeding to stimulate muscle protein synthesis is blunted. If you look at an older person, the ability of resistance exercise to stimulate muscle protein synthesis is also blunted, and this is called anabolic resistance. We don't really understand what is regulating anabolic resistance. So it could be a simple argument, well, it's due to the fact that older people are moving less. And indeed, if you put a young person in bed or you put them in a limb cast, you see anabolic resistance develops pretty quickly. So one simple explanation would be, well, these aging-related responses are due to inactivity. But in both conditions, whether it's an immobilized young person or an elderly person, we don't yet clearly understand what's regulating at a molecular level. So, for example, studies done by, I think the first observation was study of Mike Rennie. So if you put an older person in a cast, the phosphorylation of the mTOR pathway, which everyone believes plays an integral role in regulating muscle protein synthesis, the phosphorylation status of these proteins were no different, despite muscle protein synthesis declining quite significantly. At the other end of the argument, you have if you give drugs that block mTOR, the mTOR pathway, like rapamycin, this clearly blunts muscle protein synthesis. So this probably tells us that, you know, measuring protein phosphorylation is not as sophisticated as we originally thought. So I guess what I'm saying is we need better methods. We need the event of proteomics, the increased improvement in methods where you can measure muscle protein synthesis now in free living people over extended periods of time, rather than just over a 3-hour period in the lab, for example, is really going to help things.
And I think, as we say in the review, Christoph, looking at other systems as well, you know, so is the inactivity driven by compromise in the lung system? That's what we don't know. It's not going to be homogeneous in the frail patients. We think that the systems affected and the initial drivers will be really heterogeneous. And that's why you need a personalized approach.
I think you also need to study frail people.
And longitudinally.
And we started some studies in frail people here. And I naively thought, well, these were frail people that had a fall, so they had to be immobilized. And I naively thought, well, this is a really good model because they're already frail and they're going to be immobilized. So we can study the loss of muscle mass over time in these frail people. And what we generally saw is, well, these people are already wasted. And if you immobilize them, there's no greater loss of muscle mass. So that begs the question, well, is it too late to intervene in frail people? But then you counter that with, I mentioned earlier, the studies of Bill Evans. The introduction of resistance exercise was really very powerful in stimulating functionality. So we need to do more studies in frail old people. That's essential.
Yeah. And I think, Paul, as well, even in the robust and the pre-frail. So again, we've done studies in people who were robust and then had a fall and a hip fracture, and we followed them. And it was interesting that the ones that really then became frail and didn't recover 6 months later had one of their main problems was they had a problem with the HPA axis. So their cortisol to DHS ratio was raised and they developed also mild depression. So they had catabolic drivers there going on. And that they really didn't, you know, recover and were then certainly most of them pre-frail or frail 6 months later. So again, those longitudinal studies can tell you what some of the drivers are. And we certainly hadn't predicted that at all. You know, we were looking at the HPA axis, but it was absolutely as clear as day that the ones that had the really poor recovery and went on to be pre-frail and frail just didn't have, or certainly had this exaggerated HPA axis response.
And again, I know I mentioned it earlier, this is a really good area for physiologists to get into because the methods available, you know, particularly the development of MR imaging, it's a really accelerated rate of development of methods. And the application of these methods is relatively non-invasive. So, you know, you can really, I think, make physiologists working with physicists can start making enormous strides in this area. And the idea of bringing a frail person into an exercise physiology lab and doing, you know, comprehensive detailed studies was problematic. These people lack resilience. They don't want to do these things, but it is becoming less challenging for them by applying non-invasive methodologies.
I mean, that's something that also comes out in your review. I mean, you very nicely summarized the state of the art of the field at the present time and also delineate ways how to move forward. Still, many countries, many societies, we have an aging demographics. And the question is, also talking about frail, pre-frail therapy, prevention. Are there things that we should do now or should do now in a more structured or a stronger manner? Emphasize maybe prevention, change the mindset of patients, of doctors, to cement and expand the use, for example, of structured exercise and other interventions in the clinic.
No, I think that's a really good point. And interestingly enough, in the UK now, our GPs, our primary care, are now instructed to assess frailty in their patients. So that's the start point. You need to first identify it. And even if you use these very simple measures to spot the patient who may be pre-frail and you could intervene, what we haven't got then yet is the ability to, you know, recommend at sort of scale structured exercise programs or whatever intervention is appropriate for that individual. That's what's missing at the moment. But you first have to identify the problem. And that's only just begun very recently in the UK and has been put on the list of the things that the GPs should look for.
And a lot of these things that will accelerate frailty, mechanistic things like inactivity, you know, it's very much society driven as well. If someone is alone, living on their own, it's going to be harder for them to motivate themselves to exercise, to move. Mm. So there are things that could be done at a societal level, I think, that focused at improving mobility that could help considerably.
I think you're right, Paul. I think just thinking, you know, you always think, oh, you're getting older, slow down, take it easy. It should be precisely the opposite. Don't slow down. Keep physically active, keep socially active as well.
Indeed.
Yes, so that leads nicely to my last question. I mean, if given the choice, none of us would want to become frail. So what advice would you give any of us from the 20-year-old to the 95-year-old person to have this choice? So what should we do to not or minimize our chance to become frail?
Well, you're probably going to guess what we're going to say, Christoph. So it's keep physically active. You know, again, data from the UK, objective data with Fitbits showed that, you know, less than 10% of men were meeting the physical activity guidelines. So, yes, no matter what age you are, I think be less sedentary. So have a standing desk if you can. Or if you're at home and you're an older person, you're retired, perhaps watch less daytime television. Or if you're going to watch it standing up. So that's it. Stay physically active and sit less.
There's a theory that age-related decline is related to these episodic burdens. So someone becomes acutely unwell and this changes the trajectory of the physiological processes that drive aging. So it's very important that our individuals try and get a grasp of this so they actually work quite hard to try and recover from these episodic burdens, because it's thought a point comes where people do not recover, and that's when you enter frailty. So trying to recognize these episodic burdens and try and do actively work against it. There was an interesting paper published 2 years ago where they said, even in the most active people, if you look at risk of all-cause mortality, there is a risk from watching TV, even in the most active people. So that in itself is interesting. What is driving that? How long do the positive effects of exercise work? And are they countered by being inactive, or are they countered by adiposity, for example? Yeah, it's an interesting concept, aging.
May I make a comment? I am Dr. Sadis Matalon, Editor-in-Chief of Physiological Reviews. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed the podcast. One thing that I would like to ask you is the importance of remaining also mentally active. And I have three different jobs right now, and people ask me when I'm going to retire, and I tell people when I die. Do you believe that retirement or versus becoming very much engaged intellectually contributes to decrease frailty?
I think it does. I think you're hitting a lot of the points there. You're physically active, you're still mentally active, but I think it's also, you know, if you stay working as well, you're also involved, you're socially involved. So as Paul mentioned, you know, there's really strong evidence that, you know, if you become socially isolated, which often happens when people retire from work, and it's particularly males. So often a male social network is connected to their work, whereas females tend to have additional networks through friends and family much more. So it's a much more a problem with males. So I think, yeah, staying involved, whether it's through your work or through volunteering, whatever, I think is really important. So yeah, completely with that.
Thank you very much. Again, I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed it. And I'm grateful to Christoph and both of you for participating.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So you obviously raised some very interesting points. We're talking at the computer here, and I'm sitting at my standing desk, so I'm obviously going to change that immediately. But dear Janet, dear Paul, thank you again for taking the time to participate in this podcast and the fascinating discussion. I can only urge everybody who's listening and that wants to learn more about this important topic to read your excellent review. We would also like to thank our audience for listening to these podcast episodes for Physiological Reviews. Our podcast will be posted both on our webpage and social media, and we look forward for our future interactions with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it, and be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. Check out our other articles and find other podcast episodes on our website at prv.org.